This is KPFT, Houston.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The execution of Martin Luther King. More secrecy surrounds the murder of Martin Luther King than even that of the Kennedys. Most people still believe that James Earl Ray, who never even had a trial, was the lone assassin. Dr. William Pepper, who became Ray's lawyer, has uncovered evidence of the involvement of the Memphis Police Department, the U.S. government, and even the U.S. Army in a plot to kill one of the most influential leaders of the 20th century. His book, An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King, represents a quarter century of detective and legal work. In a moving turn of circumstance and historic coincidence, Bill Pepper, who today is an author and acclaimed lawyer, who practices international law from London and convenes a seminar on international human rights at Oxford University, is the same Bill Pepper who, as a young man, went to Vietnam as a reporter. He returned with photos of children burned by napalm that shocked the world. Martin Luther King saw these photos in Ramparts magazine in early 1967. Witnesses say that he wept as he looked at them. He asked to meet the young man who had taken them, and thus began a friendship between Martin Luther King and Bill Pepper and the King family that has now lasted for over 30 years. Bill Pepper spoke at a San Francisco bookstore in February of 2003. He takes us back to Riverside Church in New York, where he witnessed Martin Luther King's compassion with the victims in Vietnam in his first major anti-war speech. Here is the voice of Bill Pepper.
That passion came out in his speech on April 4, 67 at Riverside Church, where he said that his native land had become the greatest purveyor of violence on the face of the earth. Quoting Thoreau, he said, "We have come to a point where we use massively improved means to accomplish unimproved ends. And what we should be doing is focusing on not just the neighborhood that we have created, but making that worldwide neighborhood into a brotherhood." And we were going entirely in the opposite direction. And this was what he was pledging to fight against. We spoke very early in the morning following that Riverside address, and he said, "Now, you know, they're all going to turn against me. We're going to lose money. SCLC will lose all of its corporate contributions. All the major civil rights leaders are going to turn their back on me, and all the major media will start to tarnish and to taint and to attack me, and I will be called everything even up to and including a traitor." So he said, "We must persevere and build a new coalition that can be effective in this course of peace and justice." Well, that coalition came to be known as the National Conference for New Politics. It was an umbrella organization, and it held its first and last convention in Chicago over the Labor Day weekend of 1967. And it had 5,000 delegates, maybe the largest convention of people ever assembled in the history of this country at the Palmer House in Chicago. And they came from every walk of life, every socioeconomic class, every ethnic group. And the purpose was to form this coalition, umbrella coalition, that would effectively coordinate a massive third-party political campaign against the Johnson administration and Johnson's re-election, but at the same time develop grassroots organizing capabilities in the communities across America. Well, it wasn't to be, although it continued and struggled for a period of a year, but it wasn't to be because of government's wiliness and our naivete. We never appreciated the extent to which government would go to undermine and undercut that kind of movement. And they were responsible for the formation of the first Black Caucus. And that Black Caucus was largely led by agents provocateurs who came from the Blackstone Rangers, organizations of that sort in Chicago. And they corralled each delegate, each Black delegate who came in, and brought them into a room and formed this unity of all Black delegates. We thought this was healthy, and there would be then this bloc that would be in the vote and introduce the concerns of the Black community across America. We didn't know that it was government-induced and government-sponsored and government-paid for, and that the leaders were gangsters. Blackstone Rangers would surface again and again in the course of the movement. So Martin delivered the keynote address at the convention, and as he was speaking, a note was passed over my shoulder to me, and I read it, and it said, get him out of here after he finishes his speech, or we will take him hostage and humiliate him before the world. They were so afraid that if this man stayed on for the substantive part of the convention, that he, as a unifier, might bridge the differences and might overcome the provocation that was designed to disrupt the convention. So we did get Martin out of the Palmer House very quickly after his speech and went on with the convention. And it was all downhill from there. They forced through resolutions that simply were so antagonistic to sections of the movement and engendered such hostility that all the money dried up for that noble cause. And they were successful. That being the case, we struggled and worked in that last year of his life. And I remember the last time I saw him alive, I think it was in late February, he had started to become involved already in the sanitation workers' strike. In his own mind, he thought that this was the basis for the encampment of the poor people in Washington, and this was a good launching pad. And he sympathized with all the goals of the sanitation workers in Memphis, and so the rest is history. He was assassinated on the 4th of April, 1968, to 1 year to the day. It's interesting, from the time he delivered the Riverside speech. We went to the memorials, Spock and I, and the funeral, and then I walked away from political activity. I'd had my fill of it. And Ben and Julian Bond and others went up to see Bobby Kennedy, who had invited us all to come. And I didn't know him in 68. I knew him, a much younger person, when I handled a campaign of his as a citizen's chairman in Westchester County, New York, when he ran for the Senate. And I didn't like him at all. I thought he was opportunistic, and all those things that you have heard about Bobby Kennedy I thought were true. I saw them, confronted them directly. But the Bob Kennedy who was killed in 68, I think, was a very different person, and I regard it as one of my sadnesses that I did not see him at the end, because he had made an overture to Martin to run as a vice presidential candidate with him. It was not generally known, but when he announced, he made his announcement March, I guess it was 15th or 16th, he made contact with Martin. And I'm sure that contact was known. Now, 8-9 years later, Abernathy called me and asked me to go up to the prison with him. Actually, 10, it was late 77. He asked me to go to the prison with him and interrogate James Earl Ray. And I said, this is a funny request, Ralph, 10 years after the fact. Why would you want to do that? And do you have some questions about it? Isn't Ray guilty? I didn't know anything about the case. I didn't want to know about it at that point. And he said, I just have some questions. Will you come along with me? And I still don't fully understand why he did that. He said, but I want you to interrogate him, and I want to watch him when you do that. And so I said, well, it's going to take me some while to get up to speed on this case, because I don't know anything about it. So it did take some time, and in August of 78, finally, we went And we went through this session of 5 hours intensive interrogation of James Earl Ray. His lawyer at the time was Mark Lane, was there, a body language specialist from Harvard. Howie Burns came, and he sat in a corner, just watched James's movements as I put him really through a rather rigorous, painful time. He was very different than we expected to find. He was shy, docile, soft-spoken, thoughtful, and not at all the kind of racist figure that had been depicted in the media. Not at all. He knew very little about weapons, very clearly had virtually no skill at all with them. He was a petty thief and burglar, hold-up man, but he was totally incompetent in that. He was known for showing up too late. Supermarkets, he wanted to stick up, and the time lock would already have been fixed on the safe. And the staff would say, look, there's nothing we can do about this. And he said, they said, we'll give you our money. He said, I don't want your money. I don't want to rob working people. I want the money from this corporation, yeah, type of thing. And he had a virtually non-existent marksmanship score when he took a test in the Army, and he didn't know much about guns. When he was instructed to buy a weapon that became the throwdown gun in the assassination, he bought a 243 Winchester rather than a 30-06 that he was told of. And he didn't know the difference between them. And when he showed the weapon he had bought to Raoul, who was controlling him, he sent him back to exchange it. It's a matter of record. He went back and exchanged this one rifle for another the next day. And that's not something he thought of himself. It just was the wrong gun. The guy wanted a 30-06 caliber rifle, so they had a 30-06 rifle as the throwdown gun. And so that's why he had to go back and exchange it. Well, after the interview, we became convinced, Abernathy and I became convinced that he was not the shooter. Didn't know what other role he might have played, but it was clear he was not the assassin of Martin Luther King. This guy couldn't have done that. But he raised so many questions that I'd never heard raised before, that had never been answered, that I just decided I would begin to go into Memphis and talk to some people, become familiar with the terrain and the crime scene, and see if I could get some answers to those questions. And I did. And the more I began to probe around, the more concerned I got about new questions that were unanswered. And I'd hoped that the Select Committee on Assassinations would solve that problem, because they were in session at the time, and I hoped they would solve it. Well, their report came out in 1979, and they didn't solve it. All they did was to continue the official history of the state's case, which was that James Earl Ray was the lone assassin and that he was guilty. So I kept going back and forth visiting him and asking him questions, and then going in off and on into Memphis, and then occasionally into New Orleans. And slowly things started to come together to the point where 10 years on in this process, I became convinced that not only was Ray not the shooter, but that he was an unknowing patsy. And it was at that point in 1988 that I agreed to represent him. So I became his lawyer, and I was his lawyer for the last 10 years of his life. Trying very hard to get him a trial. He never had a trial. It's amazing that, of course, most people in the United States, if not the world, never understand that James Earl Ray never had a trial, that he was coerced into copying a guilty plea by Percy Foreman as his second lawyer. And people say, well, why would he plead guilty? Goodness me. Well, when you put that question to James, his answer was always the same. Look, he told me all kinds of things. I always wanted this trial, right down to the end. I was trying to get this trial. But Percy said to me, you know, your dad's a parole violator. He's going to be sent back to jail 50 years after violating that parole. They'll make sure he's locked up. Your whole family will be harassed forever. They convicted you anyway because the media's got you wiped out as the killer. You haven't got a chance. They're going to fry you, Jimmy. But the thing that really convinced him to get rid of Foreman by pleading was Percy's statement that, I'm not in good health, James. I cannot give you the best defense, because I'm not in good health. And he said to me, that was it. When my lawyer said to me, I'm not in good health and I can't give you the best defense, that really started to worry me. So he said, what you should do, the foreman said, what you should do is plead guilty, then make a motion for a new trial, get a new lawyer, and you overturn the guilty plea, and then you're off and away. James said, but I don't have any money for a new lawyer. So Foreman said, well, don't worry about that, James. I'll give your brother Jerry $500. He can go hire you a new lawyer. But you got to make an agreement that you will not cause any problems at the guilty plea hearing. You'll just take that guilty plea. Well, Percy not only said that, he put it in writing. And we got a copy of Percy's letter to James, where he said, Dear James, I'm going to give this $500 to your brother, the condition that you plead guilty and you do not cause any undue disturbances at this guilty plea hearing. He actually put that in writing. A remarkable, remarkable admission. So James certainly, he pled. He did cause a little problem at the guilty plea hearing, but nevertheless, he pled. And Jerry got the $500, and James didn't wait for the lawyer to be retained, but he filed himself, pro se, by himself, a petition for a new trial. He pled on March 10th. That was when he was guilty and convicted and sentenced to 99 years. And on March 13th, 3 days later, he filed. And from March 13th until the day that he died, James Earl Ray was trying to get a trial. Well, on March 31st, the judge who had sentenced him and who had overseen the guilty plea hearings was reviewing the petition for a new trial, had told some people that he was concerned about certain aspects of the case. Whether that's serious or not, one doesn't know. And he was found dead in his office with his head on James's motion papers of a heart attack. Speculate what that means. It may mean nothing. It just may mean that the man was under a lot of stress for a lot of different reasons, had a heart attack, and he happened to be reviewing those papers, and when he collapsed, the head went on, those was James' papers. But there were two, there's a law in Tennessee that says if you, if a judge dies and you make a motion for a new trial, in the course of that motion for ruling on it, the judge dies, you get a new trial automatically. There were two people who had filed those motion before Preston Battle. One was James Earl Ray, and the other person was the one who got the trial. James didn't, of course. So he went on all of those years trying to get that trial and was unsuccessful. Meanwhile, the state's case was articulated in a number of books by Gerald Frank, a chap called McMillan, eventually commentaries by David Garrow, and ultimately a fellow called Gerald Posner. They're always the same line, always the same story, unyieldingly lone assassin, no conspiracy, and no deviation at all. And that's been the case from the beginning to the end. Well, I tried to get James a trial for many years, but in the initial stages, we lost all the way up through the Supreme Court. We were denied. And I guess we finished that process around 1990, 89, 90, 91. It was certainly completed. In 1992, I got the idea that why don't we just try to do this trial on television? And so HBO in this country and Thames Television in the UK sponsored a television trial called The Trial of James Earl Ray. We tried the case in 1992. Which was, of course, the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Martin King. The judge was a former federal judge, Marvin Frankel, out of New York. Very tough judge. We fought all the time, particularly in chambers. Eventually, we became friends, but it was very hostile during the trial. The prosecutor was Hickman Ewing, Jr., was a former U.S. attorney who had won 200 cases, 200 straight prosecution cases as a U.S. attorney. And some of you may know him and know the name. He was Ken Starr's number two on the Whitewater investigations for a number of months, if not years. The jury came from all over the country. And The rules were the very strictly adhered to were the rules, criminal procedure of the state of Tennessee. So it was a serious trial. It had no script or anything. The witnesses were not scripted in any way. It took the jury about 7 hours after that television trial to come back with a verdict of not guilty, James Array. You probably never heard of that because it was not reported anywhere. And if it was, it was mentioned once or twice in a couple of media entities. It was called entertainment. It wasn't really serious, you see. It was some form of entertainment. But what it did do was to bring to the fore witnesses and information that had not been possible to get before that. So that way was very helpful. And in one instance, we had four witnesses whose testimony would have caused the indictment of a man called Lloyd Jowers, who owned Jim's Grill, which was a cafe at the bottom on the ground floor of the rooming house from which the shot supposedly was fired from the bathroom window. And behind Jim's Grill, there was a big sort of vacant lot, bushy area, heavily overgrown at the time, and it backed onto the Lorraine Motel where Martin King stayed. So these people gave me enough evidence as a result of the trial and discovering them and the investigation. I had over 22 investigators working for me in the course of that preparation to indict Jowers. Jowers knew about it. I'd known Lloyd Jowers since 1978. He's one of the first people I talked to. So I'd known this guy for 14 years already, and he, of course, never admitted anything, and he lied about everything. But as these witnesses now started to assemble, and it was powerful testimony against him. One of them was his former, and she was still active as his girlfriend and lover at the time, so she became former by 1992. But back in 68, she and Lloyd had a thing going, and her story was that she came into the Grill on the afternoon of April 4th, and she didn't see Lloyd around anywhere. And he was the manager, and he's the short order cook, and he helped him do everything. And she saw the kitchen door closed, which was unusual. So she opened the kitchen door, thinking that, well, maybe he's out in the back fooling around with some of those local ladies, because she never trusted him, really. And as she got into the kitchen, she saw the kitchen door was open, leading to the outside. And as she approached that open kitchen door, she heard a gunshot. And she was startled, but she still went on. And as she got to the door, into the doorway, here comes Lloyd running through the bushes, carrying a still-smoking rifle. And he brushes past her quickly, comes inside, bends down to take the shell out and break it down, and says to her plaintively, you know, Betty, you wouldn't do anything to hurt me, would you? And she said, no, Lloyd, of course not. Of course I wouldn't. So he throws the shell down the commode, the toilet back to the kitchen, and stuffed it up. And so in doing it, then covered the rifle with a cloth and brought it out and put it under a shelf. Well, Betty'd known about this, of course, since 1968. And it was only in 1992, I think December 1992, where she finally agreed to tell me this story. And I'd known her for a lot of years. Lloyd tried to keep me from even finding out where she lived. And then there were three others with similar incriminating pieces of information. A taxi driver who saw the murder weapon, whom Lloyd asked to get rid of the murder weapon or hold on to it. There was a whole series of different witnesses. So Lloyd was in trouble. He knew it. And he said to his lawyer, you go and get me immunity from prosecution and I'll tell everything I know about this killing. So his lawyer, Lewis Garrison, goes off to meet with the district attorney general and tries to get immunity for Lloyd's. He says, Lloyd will tell you everything. You know, this is the case of the century. You can be the most famous prosecutor in America. You can break this case. Not only does Lloyd not get immunity from prosecution, but the district attorney general never interviewed him, never even spoke to him. So nobody wanted to prosecute Lloyd, but he still was worried. So Lloyd conjures up with his lawyer and some others the idea that he'll try to get this story out publicly. So they contact Sam Donaldson, if you know who he is, but he was an ABC journalist who ran a program called Primetime Live. And Donaldson agreed to have this, put Jowers on and let him tell this story. So Jowers goes on television and tells the story on Primetime Live. And it seems like it's a big news story. I actually got it covered in the Observer in England. I had been living all this time, by the way, in England, not in the United States. I had moved to England in 1980, 81, and moved my family there. And I was a visiting scholar at Cambridge at the time, and that was a much nicer place to raise children, considering some of the things I was getting myself into. So the next morning, after the Primetime Live program, there was no coverage at all of this. Not even ABC News treated their own program as a newsworthy event. There's no coverage at all, and no mention in the press.
You are listening to KPFT Houston and TUC Radio's coverage of the Martin Luther King assassination, as told by William Pepper.
It was to have been the first of eight installments. It became the only piece, but it was a very lengthy piece, and it dealt with the infiltration of the civil rights movement and black leaders throughout over America by military intelligence, going back to the second decade of the 20th century. He traced the history of military intelligence's concern and surveillance of black community leaders, and brought it all the way down, of course, to the Quantelpro operations in the 50s and 60s, particularly against Martin King. And Hoover's number two, of course. Tolson was an officer of military intelligence, and Hoover himself was given a rank of colonel, which he only discarded after the Second World War. So in this article, there was one little paragraph that caught my eye, and it said, in Memphis on the day of the assassination of Martin King, there was an Alpha 184 team there. And nobody understood why that team was there. Alpha 184, six-man unit. That was a sniper team. No one understood why they were there. So I was curious about that, and I went to see Steve, and I said, this is a whole other dimension to the case. I was beginning to form the opinion pretty clearly that Martin King had been killed as a result of a mafia contract. And there are any number of bounties on him in those periods of time. And a fair amount of money had been raised to try to get him killed. None of the occurrences were successful. And I figured ultimately one was, and this was a mafia hit. And that was it. But now all of a sudden into this picture comes one of the most secretive aspects of the government of the United States, the role of the Army, and the Army and military intelligence on American soil. And that bounded and intrigued me. So I said to Steve, will you arrange for these guys, whom he knew two members of the sniper team, will you ask them if they'll answer questions from me? And it took a while, and he said no, he wouldn't, and he refused for the longest time. Finally, he said he would help. They would never meet with me, but they would trust him, because he had never betrayed them. He was a former naval intelligence officer himself, and so he agreed to take questions from me, and they agreed to take those questions and answer them. As he got those answers back to me, these people were in Mexico, by the way. They fled the United States in the 70s because they thought there was a cleanup operation underway, and they were living in Mexico. The picture started to become clearer and clearer to me as they got the answers to these questions. It became evident that the military did not kill Martin King, but that they were there in Memphis as what I've come to believe was a backup operation, because King was never going to be allowed to leave Memphis. And if the contract was given and didn't work, these guys were going to do it. And the story they told was that they were briefed at 4:30 in the morning at Camp Shelby, the six of them. They started out around 5 o'clock. They came to Memphis. They were briefed there. They took up their positions. At the briefing at 4:30, they were shown two photographs of their targets. One was Martin King, and the other was Andrew Young. That was the first time I'd heard that Andrew Young might even conceivably be a target. But that's what he was. And the main informant who told us most of the information, in fact, was the sniper who had Young in his crosshairs. Now, they were, as far as they knew, they were going to kill these people. And they had no regrets about it at all because they considered them as traitors and used very unkind words about them. So they were going to kill them. And they were prepared to do that, but they never got the order. Instead, they heard a shot. And the shot, they thought, each one that the other one had fired too quickly. And then they had an order to disengage. It was only later that they learned that, as they call it, some wacko civilian had actually shot King. Their services were not required. But that's how they worked. And this was not a one-off for these guys. They were trained snipers. You remember 100 cities burned in America in 1967. These guys were sent around the country, teams of them, into different cities. And these particular fellows had been in Detroit, Newark, and Tampa, and possibly L.A. And they were given mug books. And those mug books were the photographs of community leaders and people who were to be their targets. And they would be put in positions, and they would take out community leaders who would somehow be killed in the course of the rioting that was going on in various cities. So the assassination of Martin King was a part of what amounted to an ongoing program, covert program, to try to suppress dissent and disruption in America. Now, he was shot from the bushes behind Jim's Grill, not from the bathroom window, and he was shot as a result of a conspiracy that brought a man called Frank Liberto, who was a Marcello operative in Memphis. He ran a wholesale food place, in to see Lloyd Jowers, whom he knew. Jowers owed him a very big favor. And in addition to that, he paid him $100,000, and that was to take complete use of that grill facility for planning and staging of the assassination and the room upstairs that Raoul, who was controlling James O'Rey, would have James rent and then keep out of most of the afternoon. The assassination, final stages of it logistically were planned in Jim's Grill itself, and there were a number of Memphis Police Department officers. Some of them were senior officers who were there. One of them was a black officer called Morrell McCullough. Morrell McCullough is still alive and well today in Memphis, Tennessee. He went from Memphis Police Department to the Central Intelligence Agency, where he worked for a number of years. Before he became an undercover Memphis police officer, he was brought back to active duty by the 111th Military Intelligence Group. It was on June 7, 1967. So he was seconded from military intelligence to become a policeman to go undercover with a black group called the Invaders, a local group. So McCullough was very much in the frame in terms of all of these things that were happening. He participated in the planning. And Jowers named the other people who were involved in the planning as well. Each of these groups of people only knew what they had to know about this overall assassination scenario. There were two photographers on the roof of the fire station, and they filmed everything. They were still cameramen, and they filmed the balcony, the shot hitting Martin King, the parking lot, up into the bushes, and they got the sniper just lowering his rifle. So the whole assassination of Martin King is on film. We negotiated for a year and a half with those guys, who were psychological operations army officers, to try to get it. Now, they didn't know there was going to be assassination. They were there to take photographs of everybody and everything around the Lorraine Motel at that point in time. The guy just happened, when he heard the shot, to span his camera up into the bushes. And that's why they got the photographs they did. But they didn't know what was going on. The guy who shot King was a police officer, and he would only be told what he needed to know. The Alpha 184 team knew nothing about the mafia operation that preceded them. The Memphis Police Department knew of the mafia contract, and they covered that up. The FBI's role was to take control of the total investigation and to cover it up. There isn't enough time to go into the details of the evidence. I try to cover all of the evidence that we have and we eventually put before the court in the book. But needless to say, all of this started to flesh out in 1993 and 1994. And I did a work in progress up to that time called Orders to Kill. And that book, like this book, was never reviewed in America. This book will never be reviewed in America. And the masses of people here will never know anything about this story because the book will receive no attention whatsoever. And I mean, I have friends in a lot of media organizations, and they simply, and sometimes fairly senior journalists and reporters, and they say, "Bill, it's just not worth our jobs, and don't expect us to have you on in terms of this book. That's just not worth our jobs." So the consolidation of the control of the media is a major problem in this democracy, as it is in most democracies today. I don't know how democracy can function when people are not allowed information that's essential for the decision-making process, but rather they get propaganda continually. So Orders to Kill came out. It was unnoticed, except by the King family, whom I kept in touch with over the time, and they knew about the work. And at one point, it became evident that James O'Rae was dying, and he needed a trial desperately, or he would be dead, and there would be no possibility. He was dying of liver disease. He had hepatitis C, liver disease. So we put extra pressure to try to get this trial based upon a lot of the evidence we had. And we had a sympathetic judge, Judge Joe Brown. And Joe was very much inclined to give us a trial. And then at the midnight hour, I think just within the week before, I think he would have ruled in our favor, he was removed from the case. State made a motion that he was prejudicial, he was behaving improperly as a judge, and he was removed. The family came very strongly in support of a trial for James, and the family suffered as a result of that. They lost millions of dollars of contributions to the King Center, and they knew it would happen, but they struggled on. So the family and I met and made a decision, or rather, Mrs. King made the decision. I just laid out what options were left in terms of getting the truth out. And the one option that was left was a civil suit, civil action. And it was a wrongful death civil action that I proposed against Lloyd Jowers and other known and unknown conspirators. So we filed that lawsuit in 1998 against Mr. Jowers, Circuit Court in Tennessee, and we waited a year until we were sure we were going to get the judge we wanted to get. It was a black judge named Swearingen. And he had a reputation of being an independent guy. He'd been on the bench for a long time. He'd been involved in the movement in his youth, and he was also going to retire. He didn't have much long to go. As it turned out, this was his last case. So we got this case before Judge Swearingen, who was not in good health. We tried the case in 1999 for 30 days, 70 witnesses, 4,000 pages of transcript that today is up on the website of the King Center. KingCenter.com has all of the testimony of this. And for the first time under oath in any assassinations case in the history of this country, or perhaps any other, there is the complete picture of how Martin Luther King was killed. There is every answer to every question. There is why the bushes were cut down the next morning, who cut them down, who asked to have them cut down. There is every piece of information there for history more than anything else. It took this jury 59 minutes to come back, and with an award and with a verdict on behalf of the family against Jowers and known and unknown conspirators in the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, and the city of Memphis. So the family felt and feels vindicated. They feel comfortable that this, they know now how it happened and why it happened. The reasons were all laid out. Martin King was killed because he had become intolerable. It's not just that he opposed the war and that was going to the bottom line of a number of the major corporations in the United States, those forces that basically effectively rule the world at this point in time, the transnational entities. But more importantly, I think the reason was because he was going to bring a mass of people to Washington in the spring of 68. And that was very troubling. He wanted to cap the numbers, but the military knew that once he started bringing the wretched of America to camp there in the shadow of the Washington Memorial and go every day up to see their senators and congressmen and try to get social program monies put back in, taken out because of the war. And once they did that and they got rebuffed again and again, they would increasingly get angry. And it was the assessment of the army that he would lose control of that group. And the more violent and radical amongst the forces would take control, and they would have a revolution on their hands in the nation's capital, and they couldn't put down that revolution. They didn't have enough troops. Westmoreland wanted 200,000 for Vietnam. They didn't have those. They simply didn't have enough troops to put down what they thought was going to be the revolution that would result from that encampment. So because of that, I think more than anything else, Martin King was never going to be allowed to bring that mass of angry, disaffected humanity to Washington. He was never going to leave Memphis. And that was the reason for the elaborate preparations that they had. Well, that trial, of course, was not covered. With very few exceptions, you probably never even heard of the trial. General Counsel of Court TV is a friend of mine. He said, "Bill, we're going to cover this live because this is the most important trial in terms of the history of democracy in this country, these issues that are being raised, of any I can think of." Well, Court TV's cameras stayed in the hallway with the rest of them, except when Mrs. King testified or Andrew Young or Dexter or somebody. They never came in, and they certainly didn't cover it live. All the other media people came and stayed in the hallway and came in at selected points and came and went. None of this was ever reported. There was one ABC local anchorman who came in very cynical in his outlook, and he started to film for his local station. And as he started to listen to the evidence, he was fascinated and intrigued, and he decided he was going to stay and he was going to film this thing. And he was told by his producer, don't do that, get yourself out of there. And he ignored that under threat of being fired, and eventually he was fired. But he tried, and he did film it, and he got his job back, ultimately through wrongful dismissal, but it was a chastening event for him to sit there and to listen to this evidence and to realize that he was being told to suppress it, and to his credit, he tried to hang on. But there was a narrow window of about 12 hours where there was some minor reporting, and then it just all went away and never been heard of again. Except wherever it was raised, critics would start attacking. And none of them had ever been there, the trial. They started attacking the judge. They attacked the defense counsel. They attacked the jury. They attacked the King family. I mean, there were various shots of that sort to try to say that this trial was a farce, it didn't make any sense and made no difference anyway. The family decided that was basically it for them. They had the answers. The answers were on the record, but at least they would take it one step further and see if on the basis of all of that evidence now there could be an independent evaluation. So they asked for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and they visited with President Clinton and asked for that. He refused that request. Instead, he turned it over to Janet Reno. And she appointed her civil rights division, put together a task force to do the investigation. And they did, and they came away with a whitewash, which was predictable and which was really the reason why we had wanted an independent commission to look at this at subpoena power and the power to grant immunity from prosecution to get at the truth. But nobody was going to go that route. So that, I suppose, really is the end of the story at this point in time. But I don't think we really have much hope of going anywhere legally with it. James is dead. Family has won a civil action against one of the few people who could be sued. There are still some others, but one of the few people who could be sued. But I don't think we can go very much further with the case. It's important, I think, for Americans to look at this case history in terms of the health of democracy, particularly during these times, which are more troubling than ever before. One chapter of the book deals with Martin King. That's why it's a little different kind of assassinations book, because I think in many ways that's the most important chapter. Yes, it's important to have the details and the evidence of how this whole thing took place and how he was taken from us. But what's more important is to understand how such a leader comes forward, what his roots are, what makes him so special in terms of all of the co-opting pressures that are on people who emerge in leadership capacities. And why has there been no one to replace him ever since? And why is there a strange inaction in terms of the involvement of people and leadership and organizations with respect to the major problems of economic situations of vast numbers of Americans in terms of the unequal distribution of wealth in America and the quality of life of at least 30 million Americans and their children. These movement issues are as much with us today as ever before, and yet there is silence. And what was there about King and his roots? I've traced Martin King back to John Ruskin, not to Gandhi, but to Ruskin. John Ruskin is the true father, the political economist in Victorian times in England, the true father of Martin King's political and economic philosophy and commitment to the poor of this world. He is depicted on King Day as a civil rights leader, and that's the way you're going to see him probably forever. But he was much more than a civil rights leader, and that's what no one in official capacity wants you to know. It moved well beyond the civil rights movement by 1964-65, and he had become effectively a world figure in terms of human rights of people, and particularly the poor of this earth. And that's where he was going. And that's the area you don't really get into safely when you start talking about wealth, redistributing wealth, diverting huge sums of money into social welfare programs and health programs and educational programs at the grassroots. When you start going into that, you begin to tread on toes in this country, in the United Kingdom, and in most of the Western world. When you start associating with the poor of this planet and the exploitation of what's happened to whole cultures and tribal cultures in Africa in particular, and you see the results of the exploitation of Western colonial powers, and when you want to see a movement to not only arrest that process, which still goes forward today under different guises, but to actually reverse it and to give an opportunity for people to control their destinies and their own natural wealth, that's dangerous ground to get on. So King was committed increasingly to that kind of political view, which you will not hear about in terms of the I Have a Dream speech, which is typically what he's associated with. He wept in India as early as 60, 61 when he was there, when he had never seen such poverty and such a massive scale. He said, how can people live like this? You know, King saw that, wanted to bridge it, and the solutions were too radical, too potentially dangerous. Jefferson was an idol of his. With all of Jefferson's foibles, remember, he said, you know, you need a revolution every 20 years. You need to sweep the room clean every 20 years, said Mr. Jefferson. You need that revolution. And King believed that as well. That's the background and the overview, I suppose, and the summary of the case as it's contained in the book and of my history of involvement with it. And I'm happy to be with you. Thank you for coming, and I hope it's been useful for you.
You heard the attorney and author, Dr. William Pepper. he became counsel for James Earl Ray after he became convinced of his innocence. As close friend of the King family, he helped them for 3 decades lift the veil of silence and deceit that still covers the death of one of the most important leaders of the 20th century. Bill Pepper is the author of the just-published book, An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King.
Anybody here seen my old friend Martin? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. I just look round and he's gone. Didn't you love the things that they stood for? Didn't they try to find some good for you and me? And we'll be free someday. He's gonna be one day. Anybody here see my old friend Bobby?
Ladies and gentlemen,
can you tell me where he's gone?
I'm only going to talk to you just for a minute or so this evening, because I have some very sad news for all of you.
Abraham and Martin and John.
And I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee.
One man come in the name of love. One man come and go. One man come here to justify. One man to
Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. And it's a difficult time for the United States. Perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred.
Then I got into Memphis.
And a desire for revenge.
And some began to talk about the threats that were out.
We can move in that direction as a country.
What would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers?
Black people amongst blacks, and white amongst whites.
Well, I don't know what will happen now.
Filled with hatred toward one another.
We've got some difficult days ahead.
We've had difficult times in the past, and we will have difficult times in the future.
But it really doesn't matter with me now.
We can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did.
Because I've been to the mountaintop.
To understand.
Like anybody, I would like to live.
And to comprehend.
A long life, longevity has its place.
And replace that violence.
But I'm not concerned about that now.
With an effort to understand.
I just want to do God's will.
Compassion.
And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain.
And love.
And I've looked over I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can get information how to order a copy of the talk on the execution of Martin Luther King by calling us. TUC Radio is listener supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE. For information on how to order, you can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Mariah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.